This is market speculation, and we don't comment about that.
Speculation that BP may sell portions of its Prudhoe Bay holdings affects financial markets. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 12th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Superior Court judge denies a challenge to the Alaska Railroad's herbicide spraying plans.
As it stands right now, the railroad can commence spraying on Friday.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Financial markets buzzed over the weekend in response to a news account that BP was in the process of raising part of its $20 billion commitment to cover damages caused by the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico. In an article that did not name any source, the Sunday Times of London said part of the money BP needs would come from selling its holdings in Alaska's rich Prudhoe Bay field. The Sunday Times also said that the company is in negotiations with Apache Corporation, a 55-year-old oil exploration and development company headquartered in Houston, Texas. The speculation about the negotiations and sale grew today to include possibilities that ExxonMobil and PetroChina are interested in BP's Alaska holdings. Steve Reinhart, BP spokesman for Alaska Issues, declined to involve the company in the rumors.
This is market speculation, and we don't comment about that.
A much smaller company than BP, Apache has in the past taken other BP properties, most notably declining fields in the North Sea off the coast of Scotland, and made them profitable. It also competes with BP in other markets, including the Gulf of Mexico. It lists no holdings in Alaska. If any substance to the speculation develops, however, Alaska will know about Apache. The state has an interest if such a sale were to take place. Kevin Banks is director of oil and gas.
The question for us is, do they have the financial wherewithal to manage these assets and meet the obligations to the state that are required under our leases? And I think we're also concerned and would be interested to know if the companies can take on the responsibilities to grow these assets, to produce heavy oil in the future, and to add to the production that's already there.
Bank cites completion of BP's Liberty development as an expensive project to complete. He also says that BP has put an emphasis on preparing for the development of heavy oil in Prudhoe Bay and Milne Point fields. BP is operator of those fields under state-approved unit agreements. Bank says the state's role arises when one company assigns a lease to another company.
That's one place in which the state has to make an active decision. Furthermore, there is in the change of operator that we participate in that with respect to the unit agreements that we have with all of the lessees. And so that that's not an also not an automatic process that involves state review and a decision on our part.
As the purchase rumors spread today, Apache's stock value dropped more than 3%, while BP's stock prices rose nearly 8%. Governor Sean Parnell and Environmental Conservation Commissioner Larry Hardig have met with major oil spill response organizations in Alaska to discuss their response readiness after some Alaska spill and cleanup resources were sent to the Gulf of Mexico. They say the state is prepared to respond should anything go wrong with Shell's planned exploratory drilling in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. The governor is not happy that Shell recently decided to put that drilling off for another year after environmental groups put the pressure on Interior Secretary Ken Salazar to deny their drilling permits. Shell's decision removed that pressure, but Parnell says it also cost Alaska jobs. The administration survey is just one of a number of efforts now underway to re-examine offshore oil and gas drilling. A seven-member presidential commission kicked off a couple of hearings on the Gulf spill this morning in New Orleans. University of Alaska Anchorage Chancellor Fran Ulmer is a member of that commission, and she had some listening sessions last week in Alaska to help her prepare for her work. Among those she heard from at those meetings was an expert on Alaska's 1989 Exxon Valdez spill, who believes that offshore drilling in the Arctic Ocean poses risks the state is not prepared to manage. KTOO's Stephanie Joyce reports.
Jeff Short was the lead chemist for the state and federal government's response to Alaska's 1989 Exxon Valdez spill.
The same sort of risk exposure that occurred in the Gulf of Mexico does apply in at least the Chukchi Sea, because we just haven't been there before and we haven't poked very many holes in this formation. And if a blowout were to occur, we're much, much less prepared to deal with it there than we are in the Gulf of Mexico.
Short is currently Pacific Science Director for the international conservation nonprofit, Oceana.
The same permitting review process that allowed the Deepwater Horizon to go forward, which involved the assumption that a blowout was just unthinkable, was also applied in the Chukchi Sea. And so the planning process assumed that a blowout couldn't occur. That's what allowed the permitting process to go forward, because if they had assumed that a blowout could occur, there's no way they could have demonstrated the ability to cope with it.
Governor Parnell says drilling in Alaska is not as dangerous as drilling in the Gulf because the wells are not as deep. He has asked U.S. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar to lift the ban on offshore drilling in Alaska.
Our offshore is 180 feet. It's not the same claim. But we have already lost this drilling season because of the moratorium. Ships and services and employees who are on their way to the Outer Continental Shelf in Alaska in the Chukchi were called off, stopped for the year, and moved elsewhere. So we have Alaskans who were moving to work this summer in the Chukchi, and we had support services coming that were going to spend money here. Our people have been impacted by this spill.
State Environmental Conservation Commissioner Larry Hartig says Alaska is well prepared for an oil spill in its waters.
We have everything in place to meet the current state requirements in terms of spill planning. The capability of bringing things in efficiently from around the state is in place. The capability then of drawing from the region is pretty much in place.
After meeting with three major Alaska spill response organizations, Hartig says he is confident lessons from the Gulf spill will be applied in Alaska.
Do we think that we need to thoroughly review what comes out of the Deepwater Horizon incident? The answer to that is yes.
Short says he doesn't think the economic benefits outweigh the risks. He says drilling in the Arctic is just as dangerous as drilling at depth because Arctic conditions pose unique challenges.
If you were to have an oil spill occur near the end of the drilling season, say in October, you probably wouldn't be able to get the equipment together to deal with it until the following spring. And nobody knows how to clean up oil and ice. We don't even have a very good idea of how oil and ice interact. Our infrastructure in place to cope with it would almost boil down to pitching a tent on the shoreline and watching the tragedy unfold.
A 7-person national commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and offshore drilling will produce a final report in January. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has begun a review of offshore drilling practices in Alaska. The Alaska Commission plans to hold a public hearing and comment period following release of the national report. In Juneau, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
An Anchorage Superior Court judge has denied an appeal to a permit for herbicide spraying along the Alaska Railroad's right-of-way. The permit was challenged by the public advocacy law firm Trustees for Alaska on behalf of the Alaska Community Action on Toxics and the Aklutna Tribe. Trustees had asked Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Larry Hartig for an adjudicatory hearing and a stay on the permit in June, but the request was denied. Trustees then sought an appeal with the Superior Court in early July. Trustees for Alaska attorney Austin Williams says today the court denied the motion for preliminary injunction.
He did give us a stay until Thursday at midnight to provide an opportunity for us to appeal it to the Supreme Court. But as it stands right now, the railroad can commence spraying on Friday.
Williams says at issue are the two chemicals used in the herbicide Roundup. The active active ingredient is glyphosate, and the second chemical is called Agridex.
Neither ourselves nor the DEC fully know what is in Agridex because it's a Monsanto proprietary chemical. This Agridex is supposed to help the glyphosate bind to the plants and increase its ability to target plant species. But Agridex also has been linked to various other human health and cancer-causing conditions in its own right. So it's both the effects of glyphosate and the effects of Agridex that are of concern to the public.
Concerns over runoff, contamination of streams and water bodies along the railroad tracks, impacts to human health for those who live alongside the right-of-way, and overspray on berry-picking areas prompted the suit. Williams says trustees for Alaska will file a request for hearing with the Alaska Supreme Court as early as tomorrow. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a successful rescue after a fishing vessel catches fire.
Glad they made it. It's awful lonely out there when you're wondering if your EPIRB's working.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Four Kodiak fishermen are in good shape after being forced to abandon their burning fishing boat 5 miles south of Sitkanak Island yesterday morning. Sitkanak is south of Kodiak Island. The crew was long lining for halibut when the fire occurred. KMXT's Jay Barrett has the story.
The crew of the 52-foot Nacket was hoisted from their life raft around 10:30 a.m. by an Air Station Kodiak Jayhawk after the Coast Guard was alerted by the crew's emergency beacon, which went off around 8:30 a.m. Skipper Joe Masenko told the Coast Guard the fire started in the boat's galley stove and kept flaring up as he tried to extinguish it.
I went through three different fire extinguishers, but there was too much heat, and it kept flaring back up. And we should have got a mayday off right away. We tried fighting the fire, which was, you know, useless. And by the time Dave got the survival suits out, we didn't have a chance to get a good mayday, a good position out. But we were able to launch the raft, brought our EPIRB with us. We didn't have to jump in the water. We stepped off the boat into the raft. And we just waited for the Coast Guard to pick us up, and it was a beautiful day. Glad they made it. It's awful lonely out there when you're wondering if your EPIRB's working.
He and crewman Andrew Masenko, Wyatt Adams, and David Merriman were spotted by a Coast Guard HC-130 Hercules about 3 miles from the burning boat. Jayhawk pilot Lieutenant Ray Slapkunas said the rescue went well.
The vessel was pretty easy to spot from about 10 miles out. It was definitely engulfed in flames, pretty big smoke signal. And the raft was spotted about 3 miles to the south of the vessel there. Got on scene, all four personnel, they had gotten to their gumby suits and they were in the raft there in good condition. Lowered the swimmer down, picked up all four personnel. Then entire evolution was 16 minutes. Weather was pretty favorable today and took them back here to Kodiak and they're back with their families.
Slapkunas said the four fishermen were very well equipped with drinking water, survival, and first aid kits, and their emergency position indicating radio beacon in the life raft with them. The Nacket was a total loss. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
Worldwide demand for chum salmon is on the rise, once seen only fit for dog food. The pale fish is showing up filleted and dressed at restaurant chains across the United States. Melody Kay of Station KFSK in Petersburg talked to some industry professionals to find out why the fish are more valued now and where else they are showing up.
It's the middle of the fishing season, and Dave Omer is rushing between his office phone and the radio transmitter down the hall. Omer is manager at Trident Seafood's Petersburg-based processing plant. He's trying to get an estimate the amount of chum salmon fishing and tender vessels will be bringing to port in 3 days.
I mean, the sad part about it is 6-7 years ago, we were paying at that point 5 cents a pound for pale dark chums and really having a tough time finding markets for all the chum that we bought. There was roast stripping and fish was thrown away. Now there's value in every fish that gets caught all the way to the last greenest fish that we pull out of the rivers or, you know, out of the bays.
Chum salmon is a major fishery for Southeast Alaska, and this year prices are the highest they've been in a decade, and it has fishermen and tenders going further afield. According to Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute spokeswoman Laura Fleming, the Southeast Alaska chum harvest is expected to be 9 million fish this year. That's more than half the expected harvest for the entire state. For many decades now, chum salmon eggs, or ikura, have been highly prized in Japan. Fleming says that interest in ikura is going global.
Just as we have seen the market for wild Alaska sockeye expand and provide us with customers in the United States and Europe that together equal the size of our Japanese customer base, we're seeing some of this market for ikura take off, and that's going to help boost interest in chum in areas outside Asia.
Additionally, Fleming says domestic interest in chum flesh is increasing too. While the bulk of the chum catch is sold as frozen, headed, and gutted, more of the flesh is being sold as fresh fillets in the lower 48.
Suppliers are now offering their customers skinless, boneless portions in a variety of different weights. And that gives us entree into markets like the various restaurant chains like Sizzler might offer their customers a wild Alaska salmon fillet, and it'll be chum salmon.
In 2004, Alaska produced over 700,000 pounds of fresh chum fillets. By 2009, the chum fillet production had jumped to 1.6 million pounds. Trident plant manager Dave Omer says there's growing interest in Alaskan seafood, and customers are looking for a cheaper salmon.
It still is a lower cost fish than sockeye or coho or king, and so it's a high quality fish. It's got good oil content and very nice fish to eat. And so the appreciation for it's growing, and the flesh value is constantly going upward. I mean, what's exactly it used for? It's a great fillet fish. It's sold fresh, in fish markets. It's also an ingredient in a lot of products, a lot of value added products, whether it's portions or smoked products and things like that. So chum's a very versatile fish. As it gets paler and darker, it starts to go into some lower end products, and it's a very cost effective, I don't want to say cheap, but cost effective protein from Alaska.
Also, McDowell Group economist Andy Wink says the companies are using more parts of the fish.
Probably the last 4 or 5 years, a lot more of the product that is being exported to China for reprocessing. And that gets put into value-added products like salmon burgers and things like that, which, you know, may not sound sexy, but it really does improve the overall value of the fish when you can take the high-value roe out of it and then still make a valuable product out of the chum flesh.
Wink says that all signals point to a positive year for Alaskan chum salmon, particularly Southeast fisheries.
Overall, demand picture is very good, and the supply picture is good from an Alaskan point of view, because we're going to have as much fish as we usually do, and the farm salmon guys are going to be making less because of the disease problems in Chile. So, you know, I think that puts Alaska and Southeast in a pretty good position.
Out of the 5 salmon species, chum salmon has been the most valuable Southeast harvest overall for 3 out of the past 5 years. 2009, the catch was worth $36 million at the docks. The year before, the catch was worth $54 million. In Petersburg, I'm Melody Kay.
The Sea Alaska Land Selection Bill has become an issue in U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's re-election campaign. Primary opponent Joe Miller is attacking the Republican incumbent, saying her bill was crafted in secret and does not respond to regional concerns. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Fairbanks attorney Joe Miller admits he doesn't have much experience with Southeast Alaska, but he says he's heard a lot from the region's residents since he began his campaign to replace Lisa Murkowski in the United States Senate. He says he's gotten emails and calls from several dozen people concerned about the incumbent Sea Alaska land selection bill. He's concluded its development has not been open and transparent.
I think that, you know, if you're a congressman or congresswoman and you have a bill that's proposed, I think that you shouldn't be giving it selectively to one or two groups, asking those groups to keep it to themselves or not fully disseminating it to other groups. I think it's critical that all constituents have access so that they're part of that process.
He's called for Murkowski to withdraw the bill for further review and discussion. The legislation would allow Sea Alaska to select land guaranteed by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act outside current legal boundaries. The Regional Native Corporation wants tens of thousands of acres of valuable Prince of Wales Island timberland. The bill also includes sites for energy, ecotourism, and transportation development. Congressional and campaign staffers say the public has had plenty of opportunities to review the measure and offer input. Robert Dillon is Murkowski's Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee spokesman.
To suggest that the process hasn't been open and transparent couldn't be further from the truth. Senator Murkowski's staff and the Energy Committee have held meetings in every affected community and taken testimony from thousands of Alaskans. Changes have been made to the bill because of that testimony, and changes continue to be made based on that testimony to try to find a bill that strikes the proper balance.
Hundreds of Southeast residents spoke for and against the measure during congressional hearings held earlier this year, and proposed changes quietly circulated among interest groups were made public this month. Miller says some residents are telling him their concerns were ignored.
Yeah, we had meetings. Yeah, we actually got to say something. That was anything that we said actually considered? Did we actually see a consequence, or was there any evidence that what we actually did had any impact on the ultimate outcome? And that's why they're saying, why I've got concern in part also about the process, is it doesn't appear that that's had an impact.
Murkowski staffers say the proposed changes, which have yet to be finalized, show that the office has been listening. Sea Alaska CEO Chris McNeil says the corporation has agreed to numerous public requests to change the bill. He points to amendments shifting timberland selections and removing about a third of the future development sites.
There have been a desire for us to, Sea Alaska, to move some of its original selections into yet other areas. And our board has considered these changes and has been responsive to them, so that the new maps, which have been recently published, represent a significant change.
Those changes have not satisfied most critics, including a group of small communities on or near Prince of Wales Island. Environmental groups, including the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, also continue to oppose the bill's focus on large-scale logging. Miller says he's not allying himself with environmentalists and wants to see federal land open to development, but he shares concerns from a hunting and fishing group that the bill could lead to stronger federal protections for wildlife, which could limit development. Dillon of Murkowski's office says the measure will not be finalized before the end of July. It's not expected to pass on its own, but could be added to a larger lands bill. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
National data compiled by a federal mental health agency indicates that American Indians and Alaska Natives have a lower rate of alcohol use than do other adult drinkers. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration has released results of a study indicating that American Indians and Alaska Natives have under a 44% rate of at least one drink per month, compared with a 55% rate among adult drinkers on average. The study shows, however, that Alaska Native and American Indians have a higher rate of binge drinking than the national average. The study was developed as part of an initiative to integrate data so that policymakers and service providers can better understand substance abuse patterns and treatment needs in different population groups. SAMHSA's study also indicates that American Indian and Alaska Native substance use rates drop in older age groups following the general national pattern. The study is based on data gathered from 2004 through 2008. A memorial service will take place in Sitka tomorrow for three members of a Coast Guard helicopter crew who died last week. The service will be held at 2 p.m. tomorrow at the Coast Guard hangar on Japonski Island. The Coast Guard's highest-ranking officer, Admiral Robert Papp, is scheduled to attend. Coast Guard Lieutenant Sean Kruger, Petty Officer First Class Adam Hoke, and Petty Officer Second Class Brett Banks died on last Wednesday when their helicopter crashed in the water near LaPush, Washington. The survivor of the crash, Lieutenant Lance Leone, was scheduled to be released from the hospital sometime today, according to Coast Guard spokesman Petty Officer Nathan Bradshaw, at which point he'll meet with crash investigators. Bradshaw says there's no timeline for the investigation to be complete.
I don't think that they estimate the time of investigation initially. These types of investigations, it can last as long as 6 months or more.
Over the weekend, many Sitkins participated in a candlelight vigil just prior to Friday night's fireworks display. Several tributes to the crew of the helicopter have also popped up online, including on the social networking site Facebook. A tribute page has more than 9,000 members as of Sunday evening, with thousands of expressions of grief, support, prayer, and comfort. The page was started by Ken White, a search and rescue volunteer from Powell River, British Columbia. White said he doesn't know any of the crew members or even anyone who works at Air Station Sitka.
But because they're part of the international search and rescue community, the people from Coast Guard Air Station Sitka, we are feeling the Coast Guard's, the U.S. Coast Guard lost to here in Canada.
The Coast Guard Foundation, meanwhile, has set up a way to donate to the families of the Coast Guard air crew. The memorial service will also be broadcast online. Both links are at our website, APRN.org. Governor Sean Parnell is scheduled to attend the memorial service. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Melody Kay in Petersburg, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Crane accidents are on the rise around the nation, and making sure that crane operators are properly trained and certified is crucial to minimizing accidents in Alaska. Equally important is ensuring that riggers and signal persons are adequately trained. More information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.